In the church, unfortunately, you know, we have our Baptists and their free will. We've got our Calvinists and they're deterministic. The Augustinians are deterministic. The non-Augustinians aren't. I mean, that's the language that I'm used to, or the discourse I'm used to hearing and dealing with, you know. And that's why, to me, the conversation you two are having right now is just opening up and making me go, oh, I have this question, this one, and that one.
Free will and determinism, today on In the Shadow of the Cross. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of In the Shadow of the Cross. I am Lauren Rosser, and I'm here once again with my friends Jim Durkin.
Hey, hello.
And Michael Harden.
Good morning.
And this is a very special edition of In the Shadow of the Cross because we're finally doing something we have talked a long time about doing, which is having guests on the podcast. Because believe it or not, we don't know everything. So we thought it would be awesome to have guests.
Speak for yourself.
You just said
he's got the Holy Ghost, man. The Holy Ghost, you know, 1 John 2:27 teaches him everything.
Before
we started rolling, Jim said, "Well, 1/3 of the hosts aren't academic," and now he's like, "Speak for yourself." So that's funny. Jim, I'm so confused. So anyway, we want to welcome our guests. I'm going to hand it over to Michael to introduce our two guests.
Thanks, Lauren. About a month ago on my Facebook page, I put up a post by a Stanford professor named Robert
Sapolsky.
Sapolsky, thank you. I've got it right there in my notes. And it was a fascinating, interesting piece on free will and determinism and agency and choice. And in the comment thread, two of my Facebook friends began an exchange that for me lit up questions in my head. I wanted answers. And these guys are both, I'm just going to say it, they are like smart. And so I'm selfishly bringing them on our podcast because I've got a gazillion questions, but I also know that our listeners do as well. And we are going to today discuss this business of what has been called free will. Now, we may end up using other language for it. We're going to talk about language, but right now we're just going to say free will. Does that make sense, Lauren and Jim?
Okay. Yeah, it does. Works for me.
So the two guests we have, first is Thomas J. Ord, and I think Thomas and I have been Facebook friends at least for 6-7 years. I think it goes a way back.
Yeah.
And I did have the privilege of publishing in a book you wrote.
Yeah.
Tom's a theologian. He's a philosopher. He's multidisciplinary. He's won awards for his books. He's got more than 30 books. I mean, it's just like, holy cow, that'd be like having 30 babies. I'd be pretty tired by then. you know, and as an academic, he is really, really recognized in the scholarly world, in the social media world. Tom is one of those guys that is not an ivory tower intellectual. He's just a guy that loves to read and think. And that's how I perceive you, Tom, you know, and
yeah, that's
you
know, good.
You do a lot of work on love, relational theology, science and religion, evil and power. I mean, this list goes on and on. It's like stew. What's in it? Mark, on the other hand, is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He has a full-time private practice down there with the Marines and the surfers in San Diego. And I'm assuming it's always sunny in San Diego.
Just about.
Why they put that in Philadelphia? It's always sunny in Philadelphia. That isn't true. I live near there. Okay. So Mark specializes in trauma and couples therapy, but more than just being a therapist, he's an ordained pastor, which means he's got good theological training. And to prove that he's got good theological training, he is a rabble rouser. And he's got a number of books, and guys, at the end when I when we end the podcast, I'll ask you to let folks know where they can find your books, and perhaps you can recommend one that might kind of fit our discourse today. So, Mark, Tom, thanks. Is it Tom or Thomas? I never know.
Tom. Tom is great.
So thanks for joining us. So after reading the Sapolsky article, then going back and rereading it, my initial take on it, that flush I had that I thought, this is exciting, has diminished significantly. As I started really just kind of thinking through the nuances of it, this, that, and the other, I wondered, and then it began to occur to me, gosh, you know, I'm trying to deal with this question on too many levels of discourse. That was my first problem. So I want to point out to our audience that we can talk about free will from a theological perspective. We can talk about it from a biblical exegetical perspective. We can talk about it from a philosophical perspective, a psychological perspective, a social perspective, the neurological perspective, how the brain functions. We can talk about it in terms of physics and quantum theory and possibilities and probabilities. And we can talk about it in terms of game theory and jurisprudence. So we're going to work within these levels of discourse, and they will mix. Just so you know, as an audience, they will mix. And maybe as we begin this conversation, we're going to find ourselves mixing and unmixing discourses, and it's just going to be fun. So I want to start with this question. I'll ask Mark first. Do you remember the Sapolsky article?
Yes.
What was your reaction to it?
I'll just start off with, before I answer that, this topic is really dear to me. I'm new to the conversation, really. I actually haven't read many books on the topic at all, but it just comes from an intuitive passion, intuitive curiosity about this, that says something is amiss in the way we talk about free will and the role that those experiences that preceded our choices and how that interplays with what we experience in the world. This has to do with very feet on the ground stuff. As I think about this topic with a mother who was a drug addict and died from a drug overdose, or my brother who was mentally ill and now is in prison for the rest of his life for murder. So how does freedom, how does quote free will? And so Robert Sapolsky's work, I just lit up. I said, something is really important here. And so I have looked at it since, explore the topic, and I'm really excited about exploring it because it matters. If determinism is true, it matters a lot in how we treat people in regards to blame and punishment. And as far as praise goes, and who is deserving of lavish praise and gifts and worship.
And Sapolsky was a primatologist before he worked with apes, primates, before he went into his anthropological work. If I've read this just so our readers understand, as a researcher, he's arguing that there is not thought prior to choice. Is that correct? In the neurobiology, there's not a thought there that then moves to choice. It's hormonal.
Please. This could set up our conversation.
Sure.
So for me, this is where I'm coming from. Show me a person who is making what you call a free will choice. And I think one has to define what free means. But what you call a free will choice that arises solely from that one moment in time, apart from anything that preceded it, then if that could be a possibility, maybe I'd somehow concede that it was, quote, free. I just don't see how that's possible. But as Sapolsky points out, if free will exists, show me a neuron that just caused the behavior to occur in the complete absence of any influences coming from other neurons, from the neuron's energy state, from hormones, from any environmental events stretching back to fetal life, from genes, and on and on. So I think that sets sort of his approach and where I'm leaning to as well.
Tom, you read this as well. What did you think?
Well, I think if we define free will as a choice a person makes without using, and I'll appeal to Marx's language, apart from anything that preceded it or in complete absence of any other influences, if that's free will, I join Mark in being against it. I don't think that free will exists. But I think free will, as oftentimes at least understood in the circles I'm in, does exist. And I think free will is choices we make in environments, in response to other influences, other causes, but we make a choice amongst options in that particular moment. And to be free is to have the option to do otherwise than what we might have done, to use the technical philosophical language. So the Sapolsky argument or article, and others like it, the Benjamin Libet studies and others in psychology, they seem to assume that free will has to be something that is totally devoid of any other influences in the past, in the present, in the environment. And I just don't think that kind of free will exists. But I do think free will exists in the more general sense of making free choices amongst options in any situation.
Mark?
I would ask, what does free mean? Just to clarify again, free from what? Free, like it almost begs the question of free from what? Like, and to sort of give this notion, well, we're free, but let's not talk about everything that preceded that actual choice, which, yeah, really doesn't constrain our freedom at all. That just sounds nonsensical to me. So, yeah, so how, like, what, free from what? How do you explain freedom as if you can make it devoid of anything that came before it?
Yeah, and I'm agreeing with Mark that I think every choice we make is influenced by the past and other causes. So I think freedom as being devoid of influences, that's just the wrong way to go.
That's a really important working definition we just need to start off with for our listeners. Right. Listen to that again. Free will does not mean freedom from a priori other influences in life, whether genetic, neurological, social, familial, whatever. Really important. We're all agreed on that. That's great.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I don't think Mark might still be against free will. But well, I think we at least
you're saying what free will is not, and I'm sort of pushing on what will really is.
Yeah.
And given that which preceded before every choice, all the way from the seconds before, the minutes before, the hours before, etc. Years and
yeah. So can I quickly answer that,
Michael? Oh yeah, go for it.
So I think freedom is choosing among possibilities and the capacity to have done otherwise than we did. And I think, to use the negative definition, it means not being entirely determined by other causes in one's environment or in oneself. So that's what I mean by free will.
Yeah,
man, we have now used four different levels of discourse in this. Yeah. I mean, we're mashing these levels of discourse together, which tells me that this is a significant topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very important topic. And in the church, unfortunately, you know, we have our Baptists and their free will. We've got our Calvinists and they're deterministic. The Augustinians are deterministic. The non-Augustinians aren't. I mean, that's the language that I'm used to, or the discourse I'm used to hearing and dealing with, you know. And that's why, to me, the conversation you two are having right now is just opening up and making me go, ooh, I have this question and this one and that one and that one. But we'll come to those. I want to let the two of you continue on. Mm-hmm. Freedom is choosing among possibilities. But what even allows those possibilities as possibilities for me in the first place, if I haven't already kind of pre-chosen those? I mean, if, for example, I have to go into the store and I have to buy, I don't know, window cleaner. is something predisposing me to buy a certain kind of window cleaner? If I, for example, I'm concerned about toxic chemicals, you know, then I'm limiting my choice to those products that don't have toxic chemicals. And if I'm looking for something without, I don't know, bubble maker, sodium lauryl sulfate, and I've limited, you know, I mean, or am I, when I walk in there, am I really free to choose? So
absolutely
that
not.
May be a bad analogy. Okay. Mark says no. Tom says,
but let me give you my rationale for it.
Okay.
Yeah. So you go into a store, you're about to buy a window cleaner. And I would say, of course, in all for all intents and purposes, it's your choices will be determined. Now, I think it's determined the moment you choose. But I think ultimately the question is how is it that you would have become the person who would have bought that particular window cleaner? And if we look at the minutes before and the hours before and the years before and the experience with environmentalists and watching this environmentalist video or the amount of money that you actually have, which is dealing with class and how you grew up and what your job is. In other words, take another person coming into the same store with a completely set of new variables. They are going to, follow along with how nature has moved them along. I'm hesitant to use determined. Free will and determinism, I have a little – I'd rather frame it in different ways. But ultimately, yes, all these determinative factors would have made you choose ultimately what you chose in the end.
I need to ask this question. And I'm asking it because I'm naive. You guys, I don't study this stuff. You guys do. If I'm hearing you right, Mark, you're saying that free will doesn't exist. There's not choice that gets made independently of this. The question is for you, is choice conscious or is it? Is that this consciousness somehow sublimated in some psychoanalytic perspective? And if so, has that consciousness ever emerged from that where it is free? And I think, Tom, you've written on this, if I remember. Yeah. So Mark first, and then Tom.
Okay.
But I'm trying to understand how you're playing the relationship.
Yeah. Okay. So the way I'm talking about it now is I believe that we are phenomenologically free with gradation while objectively determined. So I know that's a handful. And I'm still working. Listen,
I'm still working. Free
with gradation.
With gradation.
While objectively determined. So that's where I'm landing lately. But remember, I'm just studying this guy. So
how do you say that to the guy that's driving a bulldozer?
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. I'll be like, yo, what's up, homie? This is how I'm gonna be. What? You asked me, man.
Exactly how guys driving bulldozers talk.
We're going to take a commercial break here so I can recover myself. That was excellent.
But listen, I'm from New York, man. That's how I would break it down. I'd be like, yo, what's up? You know, listen, this whole phenomenologically free with gradation, blah, blah, blah. What I'm trying to say is when you make a choice, I believe some might say, well, choice is an illusion. I don't believe that. I believe that phenomenologically in your experience, I believe that you believe that you're making a free choice. And I am positing that probably you believe that freedom is with gradation, meaning that we have certain levels of freedom. At the same time, I am open to us being phenomenologically free. In other words, I just chose this window cleaner instead of this one. But ultimately, as I was alluding to, there is determinative factors that have contributed to be the kind of person who would buy that product in the first place.
Tom.
Yeah, I think Mark's saying that his view says that people think they're free, but they're really not.
They could feel. It's a very real.
They feel like they're free. Yeah. Yeah. They feel as if they're making free choices, but they're actually determined by their past. Maybe he wouldn't want to say it that bluntly, but I think his position comes down to that. And what he's doing in him is he's saying that something beyond our own personal experience is more important in deciding this decision. And I take a different tact. I think if we look at all the evidence we have, the evidence we know the best is our own personal experience. And when we were setting up this interview, we had a little email exchange and we talked about what is a good time, what's a good date. And we were all making free choices, not free in the sense of unlimited freedom, but I think we were influenced by our past and our schedules and our other choices and the choices of others. And given those options, we felt like we had the real free will to make a choice. And then I think we ought to take what we think is what we know the best empirically is our own experience. And we ought to extrapolate that and say, when I was feeling like I had free will to choose the time and date for this conversation, Mark had that too. In fact, our email exchanges gave written evidence to the belief that you both thought you had some measure of free will, but not unlimited. Again, influenced by others. I'm always going to qualify it because I don't think free will is unlimited.
Right. Back so then my I go pet- to why then to say it that it's free. I mean, it's if all these qualifiers. I mean, on that, if I could have a question for you, if you really believe that, I would be curious about percentages, right? So if you believe, Tom, that you're free, and you acknowledge the causal impact of our histories and unconscious processes and the fact that we're largely determined by stuff that we couldn't control, then out of 100%, if you could take a guess, then how much freedom do you believe you actually have? How free do you think you are?
I think it varies. I think complex creatures like you and me have a greater degree of freedom than our dogs do, and our dogs a greater to freedom than, let's say, mice do or cells do. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a gradation in that way. And I also think there are certain factors in our lives that limit our freedom. For instance, someone who has a addiction, let's say, they're going to still have some measure of freedom, but because of the power of that influence in their life, their freedom is going to be constrained. So putting a percentage on it, I don't think I want to do that, but I do want to say there can be greater or lesser measures of freedom given various factors.
Okay.
Let's come to the Matrix, mm-hmm. the movie, The Matrix.
Oh, yeah. Come on now.
Neo is in this world where he's apparently free and he's got a job and a little apartment, all that, discovers that maybe that's an illusion, however we're going to discuss it. Mm-hmm. Morpheus gives him an option here. Here, you choose. This is your choice. Neo, we know he chooses the red pill. Right? Right, Lauren, the red pill.
Yeah, it's the red pill.
And down the rabbit hole he goes with Alice and everybody else. Is our consciousness, is our conscious construct, the way we are seeing ourselves, our choices, our lives, is that an illusion? I mean, the Buddhists might say so. Is there any reality to the way we remember ourselves? And if there is, you know, is that, like Mark says, not affecting us? Or is it not? If I'm a mimetic theorist, as you know, and if I was to truly follow René Girard all the way down this path, I would end up where Mark is, you know. And I'm mostly there. If we're playing Twister, Tom, I've got 2 feet in one hand in Mark's camp and one hand over in yours, you know. And this is what makes this conversation so interesting mm-hmm. to me, because my other foot's wanting to move and I'm wanting to shift. What I'm trying to say is this: is it our definition of person? What constitutes a person? What constitutes consciousness? Are we interdividual? Where we're determined, constantly determined by everybody else's desires, which you know is Girard's thesis, or if you follow Gil Bailey in his arguments. The Christian category of person being applied first to the Trinity and then later in Augustine's work, is fundamentally a new thing, and it's very, very different from the Enlightenment view of the person as an autonomous ego. You know, no man is an island, or person is an island, is the counter argument. So how do we see humanity? How do we see ourselves in relation to each other? Is there, do I have free will in relation to the two of you? I mean, I don't have the freedom to disrespect you. I don't have the freedom to disrespect you. That freedom is taken away by the fact that I care about you guys.
So are you, are you asking, Michael, are you saying, it seems like we're coming back to this definition of freedom all the time.
Yeah.
And it seems like, it seems like you and Mark keep insisting that freedom has to be freedom without any limits, freedom without any influence.
And I'm also wondering, is it that we're freed from something, or are we free for?
Both.
Are we asking the wrong question about the relationship of freedom to, with the preposition we're using?
I think it's both.
Okay. Yeah. Carry on, Tom.
Yeah. I think one of the problems in this debate, and it's not just the us on this call right here, but it happens in philosophical circles all the time, is that someone like me who believes in free will come out and say, I believe in genuine free will that's always limited. And then someone else will say, well, okay, if it's limited, then it's really not free. If it's not, if it's got, you know, it's influenced by others, then it's not free. And I keep wanting to say, look, it can be free, but not unlimited freedom. It would be analogous to saying, if someone said, God is a mouse on Mars. And I said, no, I think God's omnipresent. They would say, no, we can't bring in omnipresence. God has to be a mouse on Mars. Otherwise, it's not God. And I feel like we're doing that with freedom here.
It's like freedom has to be like God is one. No, really, but
he's a dog, a cat, and a mouse. Chasing the tail, the Ouroboros, the perichoresis.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But Tom,
there
that's,
goes all my listeners.
But that's what you're. That's almost what I hear you saying, Tom. Is the people who say, well, because I come from a modalist kind of understanding of God. And so, you know, Trinitarians would say, well, God is three. And we'd be like, no, God is one. But then they'd say, no, God is one, but God is three. So it just reminds me of that as we talk about, you're saying we are free, but we are limited. But just because we're limited doesn't mean we're not free. It just reminds me of that.
Let's put things on a scale. On one end, we're entirely determined by our environment, our past, our history, or God, or something. We're entirely determined. Mm-hmm. On the other end of the scale says, we're entirely free. Nothing inhibits our freedom whatsoever. I'm arguing neither of those are true. Mm-hmm. We have some measure of freedom, but we're always influenced by others.
You know, it seems to me, Tom, at that point, you're being very, very oriented to the biblical notion. And my foot just spun right foot green over to your side here. think of the commands that are, I mean, I'm thinking obviously Jewish scriptures here, but the notion, thou shalt not kill, that limits what I can do. But it doesn't take away my freedom to be in relation to, right?
Right, right.
But it limits what I can do in that relation.
Yeah.
So technically speaking, I'm not truly free, although realistically speaking, I am.
Yeah, I would say you're truly free to kill or not kill, but you are.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, let me make it more generally.
Because the command can't control him. It's just a command.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I would say,
but I can choose to let it circumscribe me, right?
Well, I would say you can choose to respond to that in the way you want to respond. Let's make it more general instead of kill. Do you think sin is something we freely do or we are determined to do? If you think
I don't do enough of it.
Puritan. He's a Puritan.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, Tom. I'm a joker. Carry on to your question again.
It's to most people's moral intuitions, if a person is entirely determined and has no choice but to do what they did, they don't have the kind of moral responsibility or praiseworthiness. And I think our court systems work like that. As a parent, I try to parent like that. I think it's the way we function in our everyday lives in terms of assigning our own moral culpability and then trying to assess as best we can the culpability of others.
Yeah, if I can share there too, it gets into ethics and moral responsibility and blame and, and punishment. But this notion of determinism, you know, I'll throw this out there. I mean, ultimately, even if, Tom, you say you are free, you have a free will, which I'm not sure how a will could be free, because at the end of the day, you are determined by what your will determines. So if we think about, at the end of the day, your will is determining what you choose. If you look at the will, how is it that you become the kind of person that wrote the emails that you did? In other words, at this very moment, there's another group talking about Satanism or talking about how they're going to blow people up, right? How have they become the kind of people who, and you look at their trajectory in the womb, outside of the womb, family, culture, religion, and when you look at the threads, of course they would have became that person. Of course we would have become the persons that we are doing what we're doing. And so the notion of determinism and those factors do have an impact on blame. And I'm always wanting to take this to a grassroots level. My brother, murderer, well, you know, mental illness, all these things were out of his control, right? The abuse he suffered. You can look at the threads and say, well, of course, I'm his brother, if I had the same trajectory with the same genetics input variables, I would have done the same exact thing. That's how powerful this is. So we're going to judge my brother for doing what he did, but praise Mark because my circumstances and my genetics and temperament mixed in with my familial experiences in a different way and mentors that I met along the way have contributed to be a Dr. Mark. Why should I get praise for that? Because if I was in a different trajectory with different variables, I would have been a completely different person. So this does turn this whole notion of blame, punishment, and praise on its head for me, which is why for me it's a really important topic. Because at the end of the day,
it is.
You're saying there, but for the grace of God, go I.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say there, there for the grace of nature. As it unfolds, unfolding, billions of years of evolutionary processes. God is not controlling things. These are just.
No, I'm with you. Just thinking of that common phrase.
I gotcha. I like to change that a little bit.
That's an interesting, Tom.
Let me start one thing I think Mark and I agree on, and then I'll talk about what his good comments. I think Mark and I both agree that God is not controlling everything.
Right.
So we're not theological determinists. We're not Calvinists. Absolutely. So the question is really...
Thank you, Lord Jesus.
The question is really, as I see it at least, does our histories determine our present? And Mark is right to say that, in my way of putting it, our histories strongly influence who we become. But there's two problems with Mark's argumentation as he lays it out. One problem is that we can look at people with similar histories, let's say history of mental problems or history of abuse, and we can see different outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't seem like similar histories determine people coming into the same place in the future.
But they had different variables, Tom.
That's the second part. The second part. There's no two histories that are exactly the same.
That's correct.
So if that's the case, we really can't say, well, their history obviously put them where they are right here. Or I can't say, well, their history, obviously they made all the wrong free choices. Every history is going to be different. Mm-hmm. I think then that should return us to what is the empirical data we know best? And the empirical data we know best is that we seem to be making choices moment by moment amongst options.
I like how
we can't know for sure. I'll put that on the table, Mark. I don't know that my view is the correct one. It just seems to be the case that we are making free choices. Science, you know, if we say, look at what the science says, well, the science is someone's experience and theory of what the world is like. And so it's also based on experience. Jump in there.
the science is actually almost proving determinism. Because if you look at how do ACE scores, adverse childhood experiences, shape people as they go into adulthood, right? And there's actually percentages. There's the reality that if you had this kind of trauma, that most likely you will have a decrease in self-regulation. You will have trouble in your relation. Like, it's like a no-brainer. If you have certain genetics, that will affect who you – look at people who are obese, right? We used to say, oh, look at them. They're making poor choices. But now we can understand that there's particular aspects of their brain where that part of them that can't shut off the notion of satiation is being an effect here, plus other aspects of their genetics. So science for me points to the fact that determinative factors contribute to who we are. How could it not? To such an extent that people can, you're an open and relational and another one's a Calvinist. One's a murderer. One's on the fields cleaning up garbage in the sea. And if we looked at their trajectories and their genetics and their womb experience and religious and all that, we say, of course, it makes perfect sense.
Lauren and Jim, going to bring you guys in here. You've heard now Mark and Tom engage, and I am curious about how this is landing on you guys, what you're thinking.
Well, one thought I'm pondering is, this is for Mark, is I see what you're saying for like in my life to where I am today, or if I'm talking to someone to where they are, that, you know, the background, what they've been through, determining that this is where they're at. That makes total – and I used to teach. Mm-hmm. So I would see that in students and dealing with trauma. And so I totally get that. The part that puzzles me, and I'd love to hear you expand on, is how does your view then play into with you as a counselor? Mm-hmm. Isn't counseling about people making choices to change – the trajectory that they're on.
I got
on.
An answer for that.
So okay, yeah, because I'd love to hear it.
I absolutely love the question. And it was actually posed to me by someone who was a therapist themselves and got very, I thought, there was a little bit of anger because they say, well, Mark, you know, what are you going to work with a victim of sexual trauma? And you're going to tell them, well, they're rapists, you know, they just couldn't help themselves. And so then I had to think about this very topic. For me, determinism, or however you want to talk about this, it invites so much compassion. When I'm in a therapist room, when I'm in the therapy room, and I can both have empathy for the victim and the perpetrator, right? Because if I had the same experiences, genetics, you know, all the encounters that this person had to perpetrate this heinous act, then I would have done that myself. I mean, like my brother, right? We're in the same. So this hits home. So I can say, if not for the grace of the unfolding of reality as it is, then I would have been someone differently. So there's a lot of compassion. And of course, for the victim, of course, I want to enter into their experience with empathy, with compassion. And I would never tell them, well, their perpetrator couldn't help it. I would say that what's interesting in the therapeutic process is at some point, not for everybody, but part of their healing experience, and particularly when we look at parents and, oh, because at first I was like, fuck you, Mom and Dad. How could you do this? You abused me, neglected me. And then at some point, anger is really important. At some point, wow, my father's father was in the war and he actually abused my dad. And oh, of course, look what he went. So empathy. But I will say in another end, this is more to your question. And here's the beautiful piece about determinism, is that it does have this open, I'm still an open and relational person, right? In the sense that the universe is open, but with constraints. I could never be a basketball star. It's just not going to happen, right? There are constraints, even though everything, the universe is open in that way. But while it is determined, no one knows the outcome of what the next moment will bring. And that's the beauty of it, right? Like there's the computational irreducibility that we could never know. So when I'm working with a client, I don't know what their capacity is. I don't know what variables are going on. My input is another piece of data, another piece of, you know, loving input that maybe potentially can change the trajectory of their lives. The point is, I don't know with their makeup and their genetics and their experiences, will they be the kind of client who can move past trauma to transformation? Will they be the couple that I can bring healing and wholeness and help facilitate that? Or will they be, because of the trajectory of their lives, be one who experiences divorce? I don't know. So that makes the therapeutic space alive. Yes, everything's unfolding the way it's going to unfold, but I don't know what that is. And so it becomes a dance of mystery. And there's something really beautiful about it and meaningful, even though on another level, I could say, given the past, preceding moments, seconds, hours, years, billions of years, that this will unfold the way it's going to unfold. But I don't know how it's going to unfold.
Tom, I was just saying, so it's kind of like you're saying you're creating a new culture in a way that molds them as opposed to the past. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I'm saying that we can't get away from the past. The last second, but the morning before, let's say they had terrible sleep. Sleep is one variable that would affect our process in the therapy room. The food they ate,
right.
My interaction with my wife would affect. That's why we can't escape. It's the matrix in that way. We can't escape the past in that way. But because I don't know what the future is, and I don't know what can happen, hey, my variable, my input in this room could have a really cool output and transformational experience. It could not. So I have the utmost of compassion. If there's some, in other words, some people can say, well, look at the choice I made to meditate and be the kind of person who, you know, does the right thing. Well, doing the right thing is actually based also on the health of our prefrontal cortex, was that part of us that can make the right decisions in the right moment. But that was developed when we were young, and depending on the level of trauma affected that prefrontal cortex. So I don't know what I'm dealing with in the room. They may struggle for years. Some could actually die. I've had clients die, suicide, addiction, but I'm going to do everything I can because I don't know what the outcome is. And that's beautiful to me.
Wow. What a great conversation. This podcast went pretty long, so we're dividing it into two parts. So thank you for joining us for part one. We will have part two of the debate on free will and determinism with Thomas J. Ord and Mark Karras. We'll have that part up next week. We'll talk to you then.